south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Okay, now I'd like to start out today's program with something that might not seem related to living in Latin America, but it really does, more than you think, believe me. Now, you might remember a year or so ago when Cyprus had that big blowout. When the banks failed and they had what they call a bail-in, not a bailout, where the actual depositors in those banks were gouged, raped, and swindled out of their own money to make the banks and the system so-called solvent again. Well, do you think that those banks just suddenly hit the wall and the bankers scrambled, got together, had a meeting, and came up with that solution in an afternoon, a day, or even a week? Well, you know what? That solution did not come out of thin air. That was all part of a preconceived plan. A central banker's white paper, as a matter of fact, that you can read on the internet, though banking stuff's always very boring. Now, if you're not familiar with the central banking group, it's called BIS, Bank of International Settlements, and they're like the mothership for all central banks. So, note that when the next big economic blowout comes, the next big blast, the banks, meaning your bank, will be confiscating at least part of your local bank account. They'll dip into your deposits. Just like in Cyprus, they'll take a piece and you'll have no say over it. Now, I'm sure you're thinking, yeah, Johnny, you're an alarmist. That'll never happen here. That's Cyprus, a puky little island halfway between Turkey and Africa. But when the next blowout comes in the first world, this is what your politicians are going to say. Mark my words, because the script is already written. Just bear with me a few seconds more and I will get to the Latin American connection. Don't worry. The bankers and politicians are gonna tell the public, you know, people with money in the bank, in all respective countries. And note that all G20 countries have signed on to this now. It's a plan that's been in existence for a while now called Basel III. That's Basel III. It's a framework of financial banking regulations to which that bail-in capital feature is absolutely key. So, whether you knew it or not, and you probably didn't, for all the G20 countries, as of January 1st, 2013, they've all agreed to the depositor bail-in feature. And here's how they say it in the white paper. They say capital alone is insufficient to make a bank safe during a crisis. Access to more liquidity is essential. Therefore, bail-in capital from depositors will have a key role to play in maintaining confidence in the system. Now, if you remember, the last time in 2007-2008, when the financial system nearly collapsed, the Fed, through U.S. taxpayers and bond issues, paid for it with a massive bailout. The QE, 1, 2, 3, infinitum and all that. But during the next crisis, which is expected to be much worse, it'll be the banks, individual depositors and account holders that will shore up the system. In fact, the central bankers that put this together are so arrogant about it, you can actually see a YouTube video spelling out the whole thing. And it's their video. Of course, it's out there, but no one's watching it because banking stuff is so terribly boring. Like watching two frogs fornicate. Though even that's probably 100% more interesting. So, in this YouTube video, they're explaining Basel III, and they flat out say, depositors' money will be used to shore up banks in a crisis. So you could be minding your own business in Sweden or France or Canada, and you could wake up in the morning, turn on the news, and see that one of the G20 countries has had a financial blowout. For example, a derivative blowout, a liquidity crisis, or a central bank failure. And you, as an account holder depositor in a bank in a G20 country, will be on the hook for their loss. Because all G20 countries signed on to Basel III and, quote, in a crisis, we'll socialize the losses. So what's that mean for all you guys and gals up there in gringo land? That means you want to keep very little money on deposit in your bank. Which brings us to banks in Latin America. Now, in the last month or so, I've done a couple of shows talking about certain ways to use banks down here in Latin America. And I also mentioned you don't want to keep a great deal of money in banks down here for the long term either.
However, there are only three Latin American countries in the G20, Mexico, Argentina, and Brazil. And the other 17 Latin countries don't belong, so when the bail-ins start, at least your money will be safe if you have it in one of those countries' banks. And of course, we'll be talking a lot more about the banking subject and SA corporations and how to remain anonymous, etc. down here in Latin America. I'll be hitting on that and much more at my upcoming January 2015 seminar. In fact, as you probably figured out, there's a lot of things we talk about at the seminar that we can't mention on the radio. And about my upcoming seminar, which will be 6 days and nights of boots on the ground down here in Central America, in and around Guatemala. That said, here's one thing that you have to remember. What's perfectly legal down here in Latin America just might not be legal up in the States. So once you're down here and get your boots on the ground for a while, and you talk to some professionals and some long-term expats, you'll know exactly what I mean. So why do I mention that? Because I do get emails of that sort. People do ask me if some of the edgy things we might talk about at the seminar are in fact legal. And I say, 100% legal. Down here in Latin America, anyway. That said, I'll refer you to a recent book called Three Felonies a Day. Again, it's called Three Felonies a Day. It's a book written by famed defense attorney Harvey Silverman, a guy who writes for the Wall Street Journal, the National Law Journal, the New York Times, etc., etc. And in his book, he says that the average professional person in this country likely commits at least three felonies a day and remains totally clueless about it. And in that book, he tells us how the feds can pin a crime, a felony, on anyone in the U.S. that they feel like picking on, since there's over 72,000 federal laws on the books that can be broken. And here's how it relates to becoming an expat down here in Latin America. If, up in the States, you have a felony or are even accused of a felony or suspected of committing a felony, the U.S. State Department can tag, pull, or revoke your U.S. passport. And you won't even know it till you try to cross a border. So, for example, if you're a bit subversive and you protest or you write letters to your congressman or belong to a vocal religious group or you're a prepper or a hoarder or perhaps you read or contribute to anti-government blogs or whatever, if Big Brother and Uncle Sam want to stop you from leaving the country for any reason, they'll just pick one of those felonies you never knew you committed and block your passport and or hold up your passport renewal process. So basically, at the whim of any one of those alphabet agencies in the U.S. government, you could be a prisoner in your own country. Fact is, U.S. citizens have had their passports blocked for much less than a felony, like being behind in alimony and child support. Not to mention, hundreds of people have had their passports blocked because they defaulted on their school loans. The fact is, more than 500,000 adult Americans are in default on their school loans right now. That means every one of them could have their passports pulled. So where am I going with this? Well, it all boils down to the fact that you need an exit strategy, a plan B. And you know, all the preppers up in the States, they say there's millions of them now. Well, deep down, the intelligent ones anyway have to know you can't sit in the basement with your pallets of water and ammo and beans. Talk about stress. What kind of life and what kind of survival strategy is that? What you need is a plan B that's comfortable, safe, viable, and cheap. And the fact is, you wouldn't be listening to this program right now if you weren't considering Latin America as your plan B. So, again, come on down and get your boots on the ground with me at my Expat Wisdom Seminar in January 2015. And since the seminar won't get underway for 2 months, you've got time to sign up. But as of today, we're over half filled already, so don't put it off too long. Now, I know it takes a while to get your ducks lined up, vacations and time off and all that. And quite a few people have sent me emails saying they're trying to line all that stuff up right now. That said, I've got some spots open, but don't procrastinate. Just go to expatwisdom.com, click on the seminar link for full details. And now for all you folks who are thinking about South America as your final expat destination, if that's your plan B, here's some food for thought. Here are a few things you should add to the mix before you decide on a country. Now, one thing I know is that a lot of very health-conscious, smart people listen to this show. And that was one of the reasons, of course, that I did that segment a couple weeks ago where I mentioned those sneaky tactics that Monsanto and GMO lobbyists have used to slip pro-GMO legislation into international trade agreements. Now, what few people know and what rarely gets publicized up in the first world is that Monsanto and their cronies have managed to slip pro-GMO legislation in the following South American countries: Argentina, Bolivia, Paraguay, Brazil, Ecuador, and Uruguay. So basically, GMO-friendly countries make up more than three-quarters of South America's landmass, and nobody's protesting. Now, if you remember, on a previous show I mentioned that in Guatemala, the indigenous people got together and blocked that GMO so-called Monsanto law. But only after small farm activists found out it was slipped into an international trade agreement. And they forced the Guatemalan president to overturn it by taking to the streets, blocking traffic and picketing, etc. And now some of the other Central American countries are following that lead. However, in South America, it's a very different story. GMOs are now such huge business that anti-GMO activism just doesn't seem to have much of a chance. In fact, in those South American countries I just mentioned, more than 125 million acres are planted with GMO crops, mostly soy. By the way, that's an area bigger than the entire state of California. Then you might say, so what? Just don't eat soy. 90% of it is GMO anyway, so if you're into true health, you won't be eating that kind of crap. But the problem that sentiment overlooks is the fact that the GMO basis of soy crops and other crops in South America is all about making them Roundup ready. Of course, you know what that is. So then the counterpart to that is that you've got hundreds of thousands of tons of Roundup being sprayed every year, meaning South Americans are getting mega-dosed with Roundup, just saturating the soil in the fields and getting blown everywhere. So if you live anywhere near a soybean crop, you're going to get doused with it yourself. You just can't run away from it. In fact, Roundup's been detected in the air and in the soil and in the dust in big South American cities, dozens of kilometers away from soybean fields themselves. Now, that should give pause to you expat wannabes and gonna-bes up there thinking of moving to South America. Since medical specialists are now saying that Argentina, for example, has a 300% greater incidence of certain cancers and birth defects as compared to pre-1996 levels, which is the year Roundup Ready crops first started appearing in South America. But don't take my word for it. Let me read you this from the New York Times. By the way, speaking of the New York Times, all large Latin American newspapers have a Sunday edition, a thick one, and many, many of them contain a 6 or 8 page Spanish language New York Times or Wall Street Journal supplement every Sunday. In fact, those supplements even have the same font and type as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. They look exactly the same, except they're in Spanish. So I'll quote this from that paper right now. It starts by saying, Paraguay is now the world's fourth largest exporter of soy, and demand is surging, driven primarily by China and Europe for cattle feed and biofuels. Because of that, Paraguay's agricultural landscape has altered dramatically on the back of the soybean boom. In fact, more than 1.2 million hectares of forests have been cut down to grow soy rather than food for human consumption and other crops. Brazilian settlers there, called Brasiguayos, have set up large-scale soy farms, provoking a prolonged conflict over what locals call earth or soil robbery. Each year in Paraguay, 9,000 rural families are evicted by soy production, and each year more than 500,000 hectares of land are turned into soy fields there, which works out to about 1.5 million acres. So anyway, when you hear that Paraguay's got one of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world, that's true. But that's only because of the $2 billion a year export soy business. So bottom line, in those South American countries I mentioned, you can avoid the soy, but you'll never avoid the Roundup. Now, changing gears for a bit, this might be a good time to talk about some emails I've been getting lately concerning the not-so-mysterious case of the 43 missing students at a school in Mexico. And I say not-so-mysterious because, you see, Most of these students were considered student activist troublemaker types by the authorities, meaning they were known to organize protests and such, as college kids will tend to do. Now, many of you probably already know that in a space of 3 weeks, 43 students have simply disappeared, kidnapped and presumed dead. Now, of course, this is big news and a huge deal internationally. Something like this has really never happened before. Not in the West, anyway. Sure, kids disappear and are kidnapped from schools, but 43 of them at once? Now, here's something that's typical of scumbag Latin politicians when the going gets tough. Did you know that the mayor, he and his wife just took off, and now they're fugitives from justice? Now, of course, this has everything to do with cartels and U.S. drug policy and the fact that in Mexico, nearly every single politician, government employee, and cop is corrupt on the take. So then, all you guys and gals out there who still send me emails asking me, what about Mexico? What about Mexico? Well, all I can say is open your eyes. If you want to jump into the snake pit, go right ahead. Be my guest. But I'm not advising anyone to become an expat in Mexico. And if unfortunately you've got land there or an apartment or a business or you've retired there, well, then you're stuck. Though there might be a greater gringo fool to take your property or your business off your hands, just remember one thing. You can stick it out and hope things will change, but there is no light at the end of the tunnel. It's only going to get worse, much worse. For you guys and gals who've written me saying you've found your little piece of paradise in some cool retirement place on a golf course or in a gringo colony or the Yucatan, well, like I said on a past show, the Yucatan's about the only part of Mexico not heavily tainted by drugs and cartels, etc., because it's not directly on the path and the flow of the drugs coming up through South and Central America. But you know what? Bad boys and girls in Mexico are catching on fast that your little section in the Yucatan is kind of unblemished. In other words, it's loaded with a lot of wealthy, by their standards anyway, first world gringos and tourists. So if you've really found your little bit of paradise, enjoy it while you can. Now, I do understand that Jesse the Body Ventura, you know, former governor of Minnesota, lives half of the year in Mexico. He lives in an isolated little house on a beach and he loves it there. And he says he's never felt insecure or threatened. Well, I'll ask you this simple question then. Would you like to be the one that threatens Jesse Ventura? Hell, the guy's as big as a grizzly bear. I bet you could shoot him 5 times before he'd even notice. I don't think so. I'm not going to sugarcoat it like so many of these investment magazines and blog sites do. Now, that's not to say I wouldn't personally take a short trip to Cancun or Playa del Carmen or the next latest and greatest hotspot. If the deal and the price is right, why not? So in Mexico, there are some nice places to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. And frankly, I feel sorry for you guys and gals who do. I can see why you put on a happy face and keep plugging along. If I had an investment in Mexico, I would too. But if I did, in the back of my mind, and behind that forced smile, I'd be looking for ways to dump it. Okay, let's get on to something else. Now, you remember in last week's show, I talked about how the Latin American governments make you jump through some stupid hoops if you want to bring down a product that already exists up in the States, like, for example, food products. And I think in last week's example, I mentioned organic preparation H. Or was it spaghetti sauce? I can't remember. Anyway, I mentioned that the government extortion scam in this case was that you have to have the ingredients analyzed by a local lab that has the government contract. Which means you can bet that singular lab that you must use is clandestinely owned by a putrid colostomy bag of a politician. And if not, because they couldn't work it out, there'll be some heavy kickbacks from a regular lab. Since, in Latin America, there's virtually no transparency in government, meaning contracts are handed out and negotiated behind closed doors. Now, let me give you another interesting example of this. When any Latin person, or you or I as expats or whatever, go down to the Department of Transit to get a driver's license, it's not at all like in the first world where you walk up to a counter and you look into a machine to test your vision. Note that down here at the License Bureau, they don't make you stare into a machine like that. However, down here, before you even walk in and can start your paperwork process, you have to have already had an eye test at a little eye clinic that's usually located across the street or around the corner from the driver's license bureau. How convenient, huh? So if you're outside of the government driver's license building, you're bound to see a big sign over a little hole in the wall joint nearby that says, Official Driver's License Vision Testing Center. So you walk in there and you do actually look into one of those machines, usually a big clunky antique model from the 60s. You pay between $5 and $10 and you get a certified stamped letter saying that you passed your eye exam. Note that you're not dealing with an ophthalmologist or an oculist or a real bona fide optometrist. Just a person standing around, usually in a white coat, who will pass you whether you give the right answers or not. In fact, you could be blind and they'll pass you as long as you pay your $5 or $10. And how do I know that? Because you see, in order for a first world gringo or European to get a driver's license in Latin America, he has to go through the same thing. And the fact is, most gringos who go for that driver's test know about 10 words of Spanish. That's it. So they have no idea what that attendant is telling them to read in that machine. In fact, that very same thing happened to me the first time I went for my driver's license eye test in Costa Rica. I knew about zero Spanish and didn't know what the hell the lady was talking about, and she just smiled and gave me my certificate anyway. Now, some of you out there might say, well, that's the gringo advantage. They just let you slide because, well, you're a gringo. But I'd have to say that's not the case because I've mentioned that driver's license eye test thing to many Latins down here, and I've never met a single one who ever failed the eye exam. In fact, I know a young Latin computer repair guy, and he told me that when he went down to get his driver's license eye test in El Salvador, the power happened to be out for a couple hours that day, and surprise, surprise, the machine didn't work. But he said no matter, he paid his money along with 6 or 7 other people standing in line behind him, and they all walked out with their certificates signed, sealed, and delivered. No little power outage is going to stop the malignant wheels of government from turning down here. And you know, what never fails to amuse us gringos is that you have that vision test at all, which supposedly qualifies you as a visually acute driver. Yet, once you get behind the wheel, you can have no taillights, no headlights, broken windshield. You could spew clouds of black pollution and have a case of open tequila bottles in the car. Then, if you ever get stopped by the cops at one of those roadblocks, they won't check if you've got a seatbelt or that your brakes work or your backup lights work. They only check to see that you've paid your yearly plate renewal. As a matter of fact, if you don't have a valid license or a license at all, you get something like a $50 or $60 ticket. Then after they hand you the ticket, they let you drive right off. Now, you tell me what would happen up in Cleveland if you got stopped without a license. Oh, and by the way, on the subject of paying that yearly license fee, in Latin America, you pay the fee according to the year, make, and model of your car. So if you're in the truck category or SUV category, you pay more than for a compact car. Now, note that we always talk about the fact that there are very, very few things here in Latin America that aren't quite a bit less expensive than up in the States. Car and truck licensing fees are one such exception to the rule. For example, if you bought a brand new Volkswagen Jetta, let's say, you might pay on the order of $300 US for the first year's licensing fee. And then as the vehicle gets older, the license fee gets prorated downward. For example, the second year you might pay $200 and the third year $175, the fifth year maybe $100 until the licensing fee with an older car kind of levels off at around maybe $50 a year. Now, as a first world gringo or gringa coming down for the first few times to Latin America, one thing you will notice, as soon as you land at the airport and hit the road for the first time, you'll be shocked at how many junkers and pieces of crap there are driving on the road, and you'll wonder how some of them manage to even run. And you'd think that any government, even the most corrupt government in the world, would want nice, newer model cars on the road because, for one, the roads won't look like a moving junkyard. Secondly, newer cars put out much less pollution. And finally, newer cars are safer with much less to go wrong. So then you think the situation might call for a little thought experiment. How do you get the 80% of the people who own cars that would never pass inspection in the first world, how do you convince those owners to trade them, junk them, or buy up? Well, here's an idea, and it came from an expat, naturally. You think anybody in Latin American government has two neurons firing in sync? I doubt it. Anyway, One expat I know, a retired civil engineer from the States, said it would be a very simple thing to do. It would have to be done gradually, of course, but it's totally possible. And why no one's ever thought of it, well, maybe someone has, but this is Latin America. Anyway, he said all a government would have to do is to pass a law saying, with any brand new car or truck, the first year's plate registration would be absolutely free. Then the second year, maybe $50, the third year, $100. And by the time you get to year 5, you're paying maybe $300, keep increasing the fee for years 6, 7, and 8, etc. Then by year 10, let's say, you just make it so damn expensive, maybe $1,000 to renew the plate, that it becomes worth it for you financially to either give up, junk it, or get a newer model. But alas, a solution like that is way too logical for the spirochete-filled brains of Latin American government bigwigs. However, in talking to one of my new buddies, Bill, who came down to one of my expat wisdom seminars about a year and a half ago, he now owns a small fleet of taxis himself, which, by the way, just goes to show that when expats come down here, even guys like Bill, who knew absolutely zero Spanish when he came down, we've got that gringo advantage in doors open because we see things that locals don't. And as for Bill, he found his niche in the taxi business. Anyway, from what he tells me, there's a new law in the books that says a taxi can't be over 15 years old. Once it's 15, it has to be retired. And from what I understand from Bill, taxis actually have a real safety inspection. It also sounds like if you don't pass that inspection, you can easily bribe your way through. I know you can bribe your way through with your personal car in Colombia, Costa Rica, and Panama. Here's the conundrum. If in most of Latin America there are laws that force taxi fleets to use newer cars, then how come the chicken buses and the public transportation in general aren't under no such pressure and at least half are nothing but rickety, dirty, stinky, disgusting death traps? And I mean that in the nicest way, of course. Now, maybe it's just one of those Latin American conundrums that really has no answer. Though, leave it to expat Eddie to have a pretty good hypothesis. He says, since only visitors and tourists and upscale Latins and politicians, etc., have the money to consistently afford taxis, because, let's face it, a taxi ride might cost $5 or $10, whereas a disgusting, smoke-belching chicken bus will get you there for a tenth of the price or less. So Eddie postulates, since so many government slugs and parasites use cabs regularly, never chicken buses, they pass laws so that their rides are relatively new and in good condition. In other words, as for the sweaty masses, screw them.
South of the border, down Mexico.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos. She was a picture. He knows.